Hello.
Hi, welcome to Film Critters Processes.
Hello.
My name is Baru.
I'm Jay Bearhat.
Hello.
We're not going to be doing the usual bits that we start off with today.
Yeah.
For what I kind of hope is a self-explanatory reason.
This is a very special episode of Film Critters Processes today.
Yeah.
Yeah, for very obvious reasons.
Yeah. We were talking about it before, and I was like, it's not like I think any film, any media is necessarily, like, air quotes, like, off limits. Like, 10 years ago, I don't think I could have called that people would be making come and see jokes.
Yeah.
but, personally, if I'm going to be talking about this film in a sincere, engaged manner.
Right.
I don't want to start the episode off with a funny bit.
Yeah, you gotta start it on the right foot.
Just feels in poor taste in a way that is beyond my usual taste of poor taste.
Oh yeah, we're horrible, but we're not that horrible.
Yeah, because we're talking about, of course, Zone of Interest.
Zone of Interest, directed by Jonathan Glazer. Based on a book by Martin Amy, starring Christian Friedel and Sandra Hüller.
I don't know much about the book, but from what I have heard, it sounds like it's kind of not quite to the extent that Under the Skin was a massive departure from the book. Because I did read the Under the Skin book, and it is nothing like the movie.
Yes.
But from what I have been told and gathered, the book is a lot more... you kind of have to know who all the major players in it are and, like, kind of know what some of the coded references they're making were used, because otherwise it's, like, kind of a just, like, a weird love triangle sort of story. And that narrative is completely removed. I think the smallest is that you get is that there is a single sequence which suggests that Rudolph is having an affair, but that is otherwise completely removed, and it takes the sort of concept of the film being set in and around Auschwitz, and instead of it being like, you know, oh, twist ending, they're Nazis, like that one fucking board game that people are obsessed with for, like, the beginning of ludonarrative dissonance conversations. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. Secret Hitler?
No. Hold on. Board game, Train. It was Train by Brenda Romero. And it was kind of an art piece game back in, like, 2009, when, like, people were really getting to the idea of games being able to do art, but, like, kind of in weird ways that were trying to ape the way art would be talked about in, like, other media. And so with that one, the game is that mechanically it's a board game where players are trying to get passengers along a railway, like, as quickly as possible, and, like, get as many points as you can by getting as many passengers to the destination as possible. And then at the very end of the game, it's revealed that the destinations you've all been racing to are different concentration camps. And as it is described as on Wikipedia, as it is revealed that the final station is a Nazi concentration camp and the players had been participating in the Holocaust.
Interesting. Okay, I've never heard of this game.
Oh, it was... I remember it being really, really big, like, really early in, like, games as art kind of thing. I always thought it was like, see, you're making the Holocaust like a twist like a twist ending. No shade on Brenda Romero, it was 2009, but anyway, so what I'm saying is the book is kind of, if I could put it, in a similar vein of using this concept of the banality of evil to be like, oh, like, evil can just be so in the background that you don't even know it's there, like, until, like, it's drawn attention to. And in the same way, Under the Skin takes a very kind of, like, what if we were the cattle, and sort of extrapolates into, like, that theme into a much better way of conveying it within a film narrative. This mm-hmm. film conveys that by never showing you directly anything within Auschwitz, but definitely not a thing you can deny is happening at all moments in time in this film.
Yeah.
And showing the characters basically all being fully aware of and complicit in what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, what was your kind of reaction to, because there's this whole kind of debate raging about this kind of, was it Hannah Arendt who pioneered the banality of evil, or was it somebody else?
I think that sounds right. That sounds correct. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. There's a lot of arguments where I think a lot of people, it's that comes to that discourse thing where a lot of people, I think, approach this film as it's about the banality of evil, and thus kind of like respond to it with their own critiques of the concept. And then, you know, people repeat the same arguments again and again. But I find it's interesting because that was sort of like what I thought the film was going to be about. Uh-huh. But I don't think it's about the banality of evil in the sense of evil is rendered banal because of routine, and that's how people can do massively evil things because it's routine, and so it becomes, you know, it falls outside of their air quotes zone of interest. I think it's about how evil is done for the most banal fucking things.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's this aestheticization of evil as it's like great power and great prestige that comes with great acts of evil. And the film kind of demystifies that by being like, they're literally just doing this for like a house, for like a nice house.
Yeah, for kind of material goods. They talk about like the curtains that they got from this Jewish woman who they used to do housework for. They come in and dump a bunch of clothing on the table that they stole from Jewish people.
There's the scene where the wife threatens a housemaid basically to get her killed, making it clear that she isn't in denial about what's going on. She's using it to lash out, and like she's fully aware that she's using it as like a point of power.
That actual line was based off of there are some things in this movie that are like actually based off of real history and real firsthand account
yeah.
of history, and some of the work that was done in like pre-production in terms of just like interviewing survivors and people who were like housekeepers for, you know, Nazis, essentially, like that really happened, that, you know, really came out of a Nazi woman's mouth about one of their housekeepers.
One of the most depressing reviews I read about this was like Hedwig Haas immigrated to America after and lived to be like 90, so pretty good chance, you know, people just passed her on the street. She was just, oh, the little old lady yeah. in my neighborhood, and that's who this movie's about, is people like that.
Yeah, and hearing that line come out of her mouth, it kind of makes you understand how many people around you in America and just in the world in general are capable and willing to kind of carry out this type of evil.
Yeah, absolutely willing to justify it for essentially nothing. Like not for nothing, but again, it's you have this assumption that great acts of evil must carry with them great rewards, and that is like what the corrupting thing is, but that ultimately it's no, like people will do this shit for
things that they could have already had,
yeah, for the tawdriest of fucking reasons.
Yeah,
even Rudolph, it's like, you know, he's like a true believer, air quotes, within the context of the film, but it's clear that it's like he likes it because it's a thing that makes him feel smart and useful. He likes it right. because it gives him a career, and he's good at it.
Yeah. What was up with the phone call that he has kind of towards the end of the film, where he's like, his character at a certain point, he talks to his wife on the phone and he says something along the lines of like, yeah, I was just in a meeting. Ugh, I was so distracted. I spent the whole time in the meeting just thinking about how easy it would be to gas the room.
Oh, yeah.
Which did venture a little bit into like caricature territory, but it's also just, I don't know.
Evil
is a caricature of itself sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I took that as like, it's not even that he's thinking about gassing the room. It's that, like, you know, that makes it clear, or the point of that is to make it clear that it's like, yeah, the dehumanization of the other is essential to the creation of evil acts. But there's also the dehumanization of the self, where it becomes a thing where it's like, it makes it clear that it's not about killing this other because he's really, truly, and fully convinced himself that these people are, like, not human, and therefore what he is doing is permissible. He just wants to kill people. It's just he just views this as, I'm good at efficiently killing people and doing these things, to the point where I can't even stop doing it, even when I'm in a situation that, like, socially and structurally, it would be wrong to do so.
Yeah, it's not even about the end. It's really more about the means.
Yeah, to an extent, I think that's like kind of, again, the evil makes itself banal through normalizing itself and through like the repetition of itself, mm-hmm. Which is sort of where I think the film's decision to have the contours of everything be there but never directly confront you with it is what makes it so horrifying.
Right.
Is I think it's kind of interrogating this idea of, like, to what extent is seeing the horror again and again and again more beneficial than just being aware of the horror and, like, mm-hmm. having to think about it, like, with your human mind and emotions.
Yeah, and, like, Jonathan Glazer, he's in conversation with this, like, long lineage of Jewish filmmakers who have to kind of, like, reckon with the Holocaust. To be clear, Jonathan Glazer is Jewish himself.
Yeah.
He's kind of placing a flag over in this other direction from, let's say, like, Steven Spielberg, like, Schindler's List kind of cinema that's really all about depicting the kind of direct horror and, you know, shocking the audience, when in reality, I mean, like, I don't know, some people are just never going to be shocked, and, like, for some people, those kind of banal rewards, like, they, you know, you have this unique problem of having to kind of shake people's humanity back into them. Because people are very, very ready to dehumanize themselves in terms of just, you know, readily seeing someone else as less than human if it stands to be, like, the slightest material gain, you know, for that kind of, like, perverse evil impulse.
Yeah.
What did you think about the, like, format of the film? That's obviously kind of, like, the first thing that stands out about what the movie is.
The format of the film. I've seen some critiques about the use of, like, experimentalism in the film being kind of, mm-hmm. like, flashy. I like it a lot because I had to step out at one point during the part when it hits you with the big red, because it actually started to make me feel, like, physically queasy. I don't think, obviously, it's one of those things where I don't think it'll work for everyone, but I think it's done in a way where he's using these kind of moments of almost distancing or alienation to interrupt the otherwise very stodgy realism and very calculated, like, shot construction as a way to kind of, like, shock your senses in a way to keep the image from being banal.
Yeah.
And so he has music that intrudes that will make you unsettled. He has scenes of stark color that intrude that will make you unsettled. He's using these things, I think, because if without them, the film could easily just become, at a certain point, you become numb to it. And I think that's sort of what he's trying to play with, is how do you approach depicting and discussing something like this without inevitably the place of the human response of numbing to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at this stage, we must bring up the man, the myth, the legend, Paul, our good friend Paul. Pauly Schrades. Paul Schrader had kind of a reaction to Zone of Interest where he was a little bit less impressed by it.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, I kind of bring this up to dovetail into my own feelings, but he, you know, as the one who wrote the book on transcendental cinema for, you know, at least for an American audience, his take is that slow cinema distancing techniques kind of like imply, I'm less paraphrasing and more directly phrasing, but like, yeah. it implies a sort of mystery underneath. And in Zone of Interest, there really is no mystery. It is an extremely well-mined, very familiar, you know, period in history. And to that end, like, I'm struggling with my own kind of issues with the film, where I don't know if it's just because Jonathan Glazer was my favorite director in eighth grade.
Yeah.
But all of his work is stamped with this kind of like eighth grade-y kind of stink to it, where it's like, he's a remarkable aesthete. And I think once he latches onto an idea, he kind of does this sort of like the most beautiful sort of rendition of the idea. But I still find some things lacking in some of his ideas. Out of his prior features, only Birth really works for me. Under the Skin was actually the first film we reviewed for our patron exclusive Throws It Back.
Yeah, I remember
film
that.
Review podcast, Film Critters Throws It Back. And my feelings back then were basically like that. I don't know if it sticks the landing. Same for Sexy Beast. I don't know if Sexy Beast sticks the landing. And I look at Zone of Interest, and there's, I don't know. It, at a certain point, it's like you're trying to kind of like, trying to make the best painting by cooking really good pancakes. You know what I mean? It's like you're trying to impart this sort of complex humanity and this like very complex nature of evil through a kind of a medium that historically has not had a good time portraying that evil. I don't think it's wholly not a success, because what I will say about the film is that, like, from a sheer, like, looking at it from, like, a transcendental cinema, sort of, like, holistic, like, full-body reaction to the film, you know, normally when I come out of a movie theater, or like, my reigning sort of memory of, my sense memory of leaving a movie theater is, like, I leave the theater and I'm blinded by the fucking sun, and I have to like reorient myself to what reality is after a movie.
Yeah.
Whereas Zone of Interest, in its sort of like slow cinema trappings, like I didn't have to reorient shit. Like I got out of that theater and that movie just felt like how life in America feels. And you know, we went to this like food place afterward, and like the sound palette of the restaurant was the same as the sound palette of the film, which offered kind of a moment of, you know, kind of reflection on American evil and, you know, thinking about how evil kind of works in real life, more or less, and how many people working in that restaurant handing me my food could have been from places where they couldn't live anymore because of, you know, the machinations of large-scale genocide on the global south or whatever. Like, it's, I think the movie does that pretty decently. But I don't know, just, Yeah, it makes me reflect on kind of like why Paul Schrader like thinks about this film as like a more of a parlor trick kind of conversation piece than anything sort of revelatory.
No.
I don't know. I don't know what your reaction to that is.
No, I mean, it's always complicated because any film that succeeds, for lack of a way to put it, always ends up building these like multiple tiers of conversation. There's the thing I kind of started about at the beginning where like people arguing about the banality of evil as a concept via this film, and I don't think both they're like, no, this movie's really good because it depicts the banality of evil, and people are like, no, it's bad because the banality of evil is fake. And Nazis should be depicted as like the people I get mad at on Twitter.
Right.
I don't think that conversation is useful to understanding the film either way, because again, I think the film does a pretty good job of not embedding a critique of the concept of banality of evil in it. Like, there's not a point at which any character acts as if they have numbed themselves to it. And in fact, the film explicitly includes a sequence in which a character who, via distance from it, has kind of numbed herself to it and is able to casually discuss it, and within a day of being there, like, has to leave and leaves a note, which from the scene that succeeds it, makes it clear is basically her going like, how the fuck can you live with direct confrontation of your actions every day?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think there's a lot in the film which very heavily embeds this critique of this idea that, like, the banality of evil applies to something like the Holocaust or to something like a lot of things that occur within the American colonialism sphere. The just following orders argument doesn't really cut it in this film.
Yeah, yeah. And I absolutely do see that. Like, I think that the just following orders thing has been such a huge refrain about Nazism and how that kind of thing takes over a country, and you know, which is confounding. Like, you know, when you read about like the effects of the Holocaust, it can be really hard to kind of put it in perspective and understand like how the hows and the whys.
This film came out in like a really great, not great, it's awful time. This film really is very well contextualized by both, you know, like, I watch this film and I think about the fact that, like, oh, the rave in Israel, that was like the first kind of start of the current genocide going on in Palestine, and how it was a rave being held like within basically earshot of like an open air concentration camp.
Literally.
Or, you know, looking at like the massive levels of like cruelty and machinations that are being rolled out against like trans people and like people and like refugees attempting to come into America, because it's usually the same people rolling out both, and just like the eager glee that people will say with their full fucking names and chests attached to it, where it's not like they're not like, oh well, you know, this is important, like, yeah, like there's no distancing from it. Like, they're fully aware of what they're doing, and they like it. I think the film's really contextualized by that. That's the kind of, like, lower tier argument of it. And so the higher tier arguments of it, I think, are good, where it's like, yeah, I think ultimately it's a film that is very, very, very well constructed. And also calling it a parlor trick is like, I don't think that's wrong, but I mean, can any movie really be transcendental outside of like outright documentary regarding something like this?
Yeah, this is true. Even documentary, I mean, like, you know, we have this kind of like Jane Goodall principle of like, once the camera's on, you're not getting real life.
Yeah.
But is that part of what makes is that a prerequisite for transcendental work, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, and you know, as like a, to make a very, very clear point on it, you know, for the sake of the viewers, because obviously, you know, tensions are a little high right now. There's no comparison between the Holocaust and anything ever.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not even a but statement. It's just like, this film is analyzing like one of the worst things to happen in history, but you know, maybe like a kind of misunderstood part of history as well, and like a very, you know, it's very complicated, but it is at the same time like not possible to see them throwing the clothes of like the, you know, the clothes stolen from the concentration camps, clothes stolen from Jewish people, thrown on the table, and like it, think about Israeli TikToks of like, you know, people kind of like dancing as houses are, Israeli citizens basically dancing as Palestinian houses are being rocketed and destroyed, and just kind of pillaging and stealing, which is to say, and not even specifically there, I mean, like we have somewhere in the vicinity of about 50 concurrent genocides occurring at one time. We have Azerbaijan's aggression towards Armenia. We have these things happening in the Congo and Sudan, and you know, America's one big genocidal project. I mean, it's also impossible not to think about the pillaging, you know, that took place here for such a long time, and now we have these like pithy, annoying land acknowledgments that are just like, you know, sorry we did all the raping and genociding, kind of thing. And I think that Zone of Interest is like, it's hard to even want to get a specific read on kind of like where it's plotting itself on the map of trying to understand these genocides and contextualize ourselves with the fact that they're happening. But I, you know, there's definitely something to be said about the sequence where he is walking through this building trying not to throw up, and we suddenly have this flash forward of the Auschwitz Historical Museum being kind of fastidiously taken care of, which in and of itself was kind of sickening in a weird way.
No, I that scene clocked me so well, because I have had a long interest in that type of like the thing that I keep talking about with the film of like monstrosity contained in a frame that kind of neutralizes it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a sequence basically just documenting the thing that if you stop and think about it, you're like, that is how it, like, that's what has to happen, is like somebody every morning, people have to go in and they have to clean up around the Holocaust Museum, and these images that are supposed to be this containment and conveyance of easily one of, if not the greatest evil humanity has ever committed, and they see it every day, and so it's, yeah, just a fucking job to them at that point. And you know, that to me is like where the film's like construction, I think, is like why I say like it's a parlor trick, but I think that's kind of the best you can do, is that it's like, I think even in that, it sort of is levering its own self-critique of like, how do you deal with this? Like, how do you convey something, yeah, like this that doesn't inevitably put a frame around something that is unframeable?
Yeah, and that sequence I thought was like this moment of spice. Like, it's almost vulgar and profane, but in a way that feels like, in a way that I really like.
Yeah.
Just to be like, here is, you know, this place that is, you know, it's like, imagine if Ed Gein was president of the fucking United States of America. Like, it's nothing but pure horror, and it's shown being cared for in this very specific and like solemn way that's like, you know, imagining the places like the you know, the old libraries and cultural centers and things throughout history that have been destroyed and burned, the Library of Alexandria's that have been completely eliminated from the face of the earth, but this place that's being like beautifully kept is just this site of like abject horror.
And it's interesting because I noticed that a lot of people read that sequence as like him seeing into the future and then arguments about what that means, like, oh, he's being confronted with the evil of his actions or whatever. And I don't like, I guess I don't really interpret it in that way, if that makes sense. I kind of see it as like he thinks there might be something that he sees in the dark, and instead what he sees is sort of a vision of the inevitable end of this.
Yes.
That inevitably all of his actions he's done will be put in a frame. And yeah, it's not that he necessarily is seeing what we see, but that it's a moment of him looking forward and it's like, this ends. Like this yes. project we have the Third Reich isn't fucking coming. This ends.
Yeah. Like a confronting reality. It's this interesting kind of complex moment of humanity, I think, because like I feel like I've, you know, and I have like a very subjective and personal reaction to it, which I think is, you know, the by design. It's welcome to art. Yeah. But like I've certainly had stages in my life of just like standing in a room thinking about the future and thinking about like this place will not be here forever. And for it to be kind of the opposite, where like this place will be here forever, this place will be enshrined in a certain particular way. The impression I get from his, you know, from him in that scene, from what we know of the character and from his body language and things like that, is just like him saying basically that's a them problem.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like this whole project, it was a bunch of kind of rats scurrying to the top of the pile, and death is coming for Hitler, for the Reich, for, you know, the regime, and certainly eventually for Christian. And yeah, and until then you have to be able to kind of live with yourself and rationalize these things. And it's a constant process. It's like you said, that dehumanization is an active thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's like, that to me is the big thing of it, is people are like, oh, he's being confronted with his evil. And I take it as like, no, that is a moment in which like, what he's confronted with is the risk of the fact that he's doing all this for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because his wife is clearly disinterested because she's getting what she wants and now doesn't have to have sex with him. And he's not, I'm doing all this for nothing. Oh, woe is me, horror. It's throwing him off enough for a moment where he has to like, he's trying to keep in the vomit of like really internalizing the fact that he is no longer human.
Yeah.
And that's like, that is how I interpret that sequence. And that's why he like stands up and like kind of goes forward, is that it's like, this will end and I will be rendered like, and I will have a frame in which this is all given meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the justification that he gives himself. Because ultimately his motivation is just, he does the shit because he's good at it. It's a good job. It's a good career. And it improves things for his life. And fuck the people that he's murdering en masse.
Kind of pivoting back to more of the like craft of the film. Another aspect of the movie that was based off of reality and firsthand account was all the sequences of the... little girl character biking around.
I just read that, and I think that's really sweet that, like, he got to actually meet her, and, like, basically she, like, gave him, I guess, the bike and the dress. Like, those are her actual
bikes. Those are the actual things.
Yeah, I think that learning that actually did add, like, a really sweet bittersweetness to the film, because I kind of, like, it's not that people like that didn't exist, but it sort of, I assumed it was a fictional introduction to the film, and so finding out that not only was, like, that a real person, but that, like, she basically got to die knowing that, like, her small kindness in the worst circumstances is going to be immortalized on film. That's just, I don't know, that really touches me.
Yeah, it's really, really touching. It's really, really special. And I think that I think that the movie would have been incomplete without a sort of real sense of fullness about kind of the nature of humanity and the reality of what was going on then, and kind of the way that resistance kind of grew in the margins. And it felt somehow kind of similar to how resistance, I don't know, like, history, time is a flat circle, the history repeats itself, all that sort of stuff. Like, it was this small but very, very accented sort of thing, kind of doubly so with the, like, night sort of thermal photography, which was really, really striking.
I took that as, like, same sort of, like, it's another cognitive distancing almost, in that it basically demarcates those sequences as existing outside of the purview of the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Because it dips away. There's that really, really striking sequence when she's right outside her parents' apartment, and it cuts to an interior shot and the camera's normal, and then it cuts for, like, maybe a second or two while she's putting her bike down back to her outside of the apartment, and it's the black and white thermal. And then she goes in, and for the entirety of being within the apartment, it's normal. But the second she steps out onto the balcony, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of constructed that as, like, these things that we see non-experimentally and, like, in this diorama kind of moment represent the, air quotes, zone of interest, which is the sort of, like, space in which people are sort of distancing themselves a little bit from what's going on. Because that's also the sequence where her mother sees the smoke clouds and then, like, closes the curtains. And right. I don't take it as, like, condemnatory to them, but it casts a completely different frame to that, which is that, you know, they're doing these small things of, like, kindness and these small ways to attempt to, like, reach out and help these people who are suffering, you know, several miles from them. But even then, they still have to distance themselves a little bit from it, because the day-to-day of confronting it would just overwhelm them with grief.
Yeah. And I think that the sort of framing of the, like, kind of thermal photography, in a way it reminded me of, like, helicopter footage of kind of, like, wartime. You know,
there was, yeah. Like, it gives it a, this is an action of war.
Yeah. Or, like, the thing that kind of paints a target on your back is, like, or that type of humanity does place a target on your back. And that being the case, it kind of reifies the impulse towards this sort of, like, opportunistic, materialistic sense of evil, because, you know, it's not simply, like, good people doing bad things. It's this kind of groupthink, like, safety, because it is, you know, it's a very, like, dangerous and brave act to, kind of insist on the humanity of these prisoners and these, you know, victims of Nazism.
I think it's also, in terms of the construction of the film too, when the sequence is first introduced and you're not really given a sense of what you're looking at or what's happening, is when Rudolph is reading a like fairy tale bedtime story to his children, and it cuts to her, I think just putting some apples in the dirt, maybe, or even just walking through an apple field picking apples. Like something right. that like until you have the context of the other scenes with her, you don't know really what's happening in that scene. Yeah. And so you see that, and then it cuts back to them, like, you know, him putting his kids to bed and stuff. And I took that as attempting to kind of link the different childhoods that are being experienced in like the same vicinity of each other, which is, you know, here are these kids being told this fantastical story to imagine themselves, you know, defeating a witch or whatever. And then here's a child who is like actually doing so.
Yeah. Yeah. That I think there's a kind of connecting thread that's being woven between these like Nazis and their like they're like not all the way Nazi neighbors. You know, that there is nothing, you know, there's nothing fundamentally different about the experience of humanity there. It's just choices that are being made and that deserve accountability and, you know, recompense or reparations, so to speak.
The way it kind of slowly also introduces, like, it's interesting in that this is one of the few films that makes me want the kids to die as well. but at the same time, it sort of is like not throwing its hands up, but it's like, hey, how fucked up do you think these kids are gonna be?
Yeah,
like, because like, and it shows kind of like not both sides, but it shows both, you know, like the two boys are very, you know, having the worst childish cruel impulses fed. And then there's the daughter who like clearly is showing signs of like being very disturbed.
Yeah, so what happens? What does the daughter do again that's like...
She's constantly sleepwalking and just like he keeps finding her in random spots in the house and she'll like mumble that's things. Right. And like there's like a part where like she's just like he finds her fall asleep and it's clear she's just been staring out the window at the like plumes from the concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
Like he just keeps finding her, like I think they say she's got a fever or something at some point. All of these kids are being affected for the worst for this. And, you know, not in a way that it's asking you for sympathy for them, but just in the way in which, like, the film is kind of confronting you with the fact that it's, like, even the children are end up being complicit in these ways, but in, like, a way that also dehumanizes them as children.
Yeah. Yeah, we watch the children become worse. Pretty much throughout the film.
Yeah, no, I like that's what I think is that it's like it's really interesting to see the film try to grapple with this idea of like what does it mean for children to be dehumanized on the side of like the oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is both that impulse, the human impulse to be like, oh, those poor kids, but also it's like, I mean, are they? like they're literally gleefully wearing the clothes of like murdered children that are directly on the other side of the fence from them.
I wonder how many places in America it is simply the case for, because I can say this about my hometown, but there's like a gang of like rich white children who just go around and like do a bunch of crimes and beat the fuck out of people and stuff, and there have been absolutely no convictions, and some of them are like the kids of like the police chiefs and stuff.
Oh, that's absolutely a thing in a lot of cities.
Yeah,
the thing about
kind of thing everywhere, it feels like
the thing about what's it called, like influenza,
affluenza,
that's it. Yeah, the thing about affluenza is that's bullshit for a criminal defense, but is real. Wealth does actually make you spiritually sick.
Yes, absolutely. It deprives your soul.
And similarly, when you are directly pulling the dog treat dispenser and watching it murder people makes I imagine that probably is way worse for you spiritually, but not in a way that's like, oh, how sad for you, but in the kind of the way that like a rabid dog needs to be put down.
Yeah, that's true. I think some of you kids out there working for your Raytheons and your Amazons and your Lockheed Martins, you know, maybe a more kind of realistic and detailed view of the machinations of evil is kind of warranted. But you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Yeah. If you need that healthcare or whatever the excuse that was given last time was,
yeah, the Hitler offers great healthcare.
The Hitler, you've heard of Obamacare?
Now try Hitler care,
bro. That's what Trump's gonna run on. That's gonna be fucking.
No, don't give him any ideas.
I have just been stopped in my tracks since we saw this like 2-3 weeks ago by just remembering like a sequence in this film. Oh god, the fucking, to the extent of like, we think about like it, when it dehumanizes you, it also when you dehumanize the other, you also dehumanize yourself. That sequence where Hedwig is like, I could just stay here. Like, I shouldn't have, like, it's just so clearly just like so willing to be like, you should just like go, I don't know, do your little Nazi thing or whatever. I don't want to lose my garden. I love both because it's like, A, shows that dehumanization of the self where it's like, you can't even like love your children or your husband. Like you're incapable of love. All you see is your status symbol. But also how much that also reveals her own complicity and her own, like, this idea that she's, like, kind of quietly ignoring it is bullshit. Because it's like, oh, we can be moved to somewhere where I don't have to wash the ashes of hundreds of murdered people off my children sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really nice here.
Yeah.
Oh, but what if the next place we get's not as big?
Like, what if there isn't a garden with a pool and a slide into the pool?
Like, just the idea of losing an inch of comfort in not even for a reduction of evil, just in exchange for not being directly facing it every day. She's like, no, like that's off the table.
Yeah.
God, the scene when she's talking to her mom, it's like, yeah, they're gonna like build some more walls so, you know, we don't see it as much. But talking,
build it taller.
Talking about it like, yeah, we're gonna put in like, oh yeah, like I don't really like this view of the skyline, so we're gonna put in like a bird bath here. Like talking about it like she's not describing like mass suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is how people downtown talk about the homeless, just by and by.
That's the most exhausting kind of lasting effect of the film is this, like, I don't know, I think that, like, the never again thing, you know, I think the film is kind of trying to answer, like, well, never again what? Never again what specifically? Because it is happening again, you know?
Arguably, it never stopped happening.
Exactly. It never stopped happening. And, you know, and we have all this kind of, like, reading that we're doing, or at least we're supposed to be doing, about how kind of influenced the Nazi project was by America, and how similar the Nazi project and the American project are, and how genocides are carried out by America for materialistic and racist purposes. And the kind of defenders of this sort of moral order, you know, kind of creating like a 1940s Karen, I guess, to try to draw a very specific picture of like what is happening, why is it happening. You know, I don't know. I think that's like a really good basis for like where the film is receiving a lot of praise. And is at least a worthy project. Like, you know, like I said, I have misgivings about like whether every second of the runtime is utterly and completely successful, but like it's, you know, we gotta talk about it a little bit, or at least think about it.
Yeah, like I said, it's is very, very unreal how well-timed the film came out for its themes.
Yeah, to the extent that, like, Jonathan Glazer, he had to, like, release a statement that was just like, yeah, this is a real bad time. Real bad time. Join us next week when we'll be talking about, I don't know, what's something fun that's coming out? Is there anything fun?
I mean, we're gonna be seeing that new lesbian barbarian film. That one,
that's true.
That will probably not be as depressing.
Yeah, God willing, we'll be able to talk about that. And hey, Oscar season, we'll see how Zone of Interest fares against the Barbie thick competition. Barbie. Yeah,
bro, it is so insane to be walking into the Oscars with Barbie and Zone of Interest.
I'm ready to feel so insulted, so angry, so enraged, and you know, I'm gonna throw up like the guy in this movie
and have mini epiphany.
Yeah. I'll learn a lot about the nature of America and what America is ready to, like, you know, think about and talk about, you or know, whatever.
Do you think, who's the host?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Because I was assuming Jimmy Kimmel. We should start taking bets now on if he will try to make a Zone of Interest joke.
Oh man, will Jimmy Kimmel make a Zone of Interest joke?
And then you could have different like tiers. It's like, will the joke just be, oh, it's a depressing movie, like as a contrast to something? Or will the joke be like about something that happens in the movie? Will it just be a pun on the name?
Definitely go see Zone of Interest. I mean, like, it doesn't matter who says it's a good or a bad film. It is like it is like a powerful statement from a Jewish director, and it's an extremely timely one. Goes without saying.
Oh, you know what I forgot to mention? Also, absolutely worth seeing for the sound design alone.
Oh, of course.
The sound design of this film is fucking insane. It has been a long time since I've seen a movie where like I have noticed how good the sound design is.
They talk about the sound design being the second film within the film, you know what I mean? Like the visuals is one film and sound design is like movie number two. And I am fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by their by the fastidious and very exacting process of creating that sound. They talked about production details of just like making sure that distances and locations were absolutely accurate.
I was gonna say that's the thing about it that like really blew me away, is that you constantly get a sense of 3D space from it, and like their proximity from any given scene, like to what is happening and like how far away it is. Like it is, and also just like the way it slowly like intrudes more and more on the film. Because, like, mm-hmm. you know, you'll hear suffering and crying and stuff, but, like, by, like, the kind of last couple acts of the film, you're hearing, like, direct scenes of people, like, screaming and begging for their lives. Still with a sense of, like, 3D space. Like, it feels like, you know, that is also the thing where it's, like, you can't pretend that this isn't happening. Like, it's intruding further and further.
Yeah, absolutely. It's,
I just wanted to give a shout out to that because I forgot to mention that was the thing that, like, when I saw it, like, most put me on edge of the film. It was like, oh my god, this is, like, insanely well made.
Yeah. And I hope people don't read it as an oversight that we kind of waited a long time to talk about the thing that is like the advertisement campaign sort of whatever for the film. But like, it's kind of an aspect of the film that everybody is talking about. It's remarkably well sound designed, and yeah. The effect is effective, troubling, disarming, and it kind of speaks to the whole thing of the film where it's like, you know, it's not about banality. It's about dehumanizing yourself so that you can ignore something that's right in front of you. Or at least recontextualize it in a very kind of evil and disgusting and bad and horrible way. So, yeah, it's definitely one to go see in the theater. I don't know if I'll ever watch it again. You know, will you ever watch Zone of Interest again?
I honestly could see myself watching Zone of Interest again. Zone of Interest seems like is the kind of film that would be come into my roster of like feel bad movies that I show to people that haven't seen them.
Yeah, well, I've watched Come and See multiple times.
I was going to say, like Come and See is like that, where it's like, that's a film where when I first saw it, I couldn't see myself watching it again, but I've like seen it like two times since.
Yeah.
Probably not very often, but definitely something where I could be like, oh yeah, I know this movie's like really good. Thank you for taking the time to listen to us.
Yeah. And we will be back soon, and join us for more processes, and join us for our patron exclusive Throws It Back series. What are we doing this month again? David again, right?
Yes.
We're having another David moment. I think we might have had a David moment before, but we're having another David Lynch.
Yeah, we're having a
extravaganza moment over on our Patreon.
On our Patreon. Oh, it's dead centered Dune and the Straight Story.
Oh, Dune! Hell yeah! Okay.
So they equal number of votes for both. So we could conceivably. Watch both,
and a twofer,
a doofer episode.
That's crazy. That's fucking nuts. I would be super down for that. That's fun.
Yeah, I'm down.
Rare
twofer episode. up now, or by the end of the month, it'll be up.
Rather. Coming soon to patreon.com/filmcritters. Yeah, thank you all so much for joining us on this very special episode. I am Brew.
I'm Jay Bearhat. Bye.
Bye.